John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for November 12th to the 18th, 2011. As Palestinian leading faction Fatah al-Hamas heads for unity talk, Israeli attacks left 4 Palestinians killed and 17 injured. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the nonviolent activities in the West Bank. Israeli soldiers used tear gas to suppress anti-war protests that were organized at a number of West Bank villages on Friday. In central West Bank, Israeli soldiers fired tear gas and sound bombs at the villagers of Bil'in, In'alin and An-Nabi Saleh, who protested the wall along with their international and Israeli supporters. 5 civilians were moderately injured when troops fired tear gas and chemical water at protesters in An-Nabi Saleh village. Soldiers attacked the protest before it even left the village. Meanwhile, in the nearby Bil'in and Na'lin villages, soldiers fired tear gas at protesters as soon as they reached the wall. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In northern West Bank, villagers of Kfar Kadum, along with their international supporters, marched against the army closure of the road, leading in and out of their village since 10 years. As soon as people reached the roadblock, troops fired tear gas at them. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Elsewhere, 3 civilians were injured when troops attacked the weekly anti-war protest at the village of Al-Ma'sara in southern West Bank. Troops attacked protesters at the village entrance using rifle butts and batons, injuring 3 local men. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has figured strongly in the news this week as a meeting with his Hamas head Khalid Mash'al has been announced to take place in Cairo. Abbas also calls on the United States for support in future negotiations with Israel. IMEMC's Adam Carey reports.
Mahmoud Abbas has stated that he would like the U.S. to take a balanced role in dealing with any international resolutions and the construction of future Israeli settlements. In his speech at a memorial ceremony for Yasser Arafat, he said, quote, "We do not want or seek a clash with the United States. Despite its strong ties with Israel, it also provides essential and considerable support to the Palestinian people and the Palestinian Authority. End quote. He also added that PA maintains contact with American President Barack Obama and is seeking a two-state solution based on the 1967 borders. He mentioned that Israel continues to make life difficult within the occupied territories with their constant flaunting of international laws and agreements. Abbas said all Palestinians should resist the occupation through both peaceful and non-violent means. In other news, it was announced this week that Abbas will be meeting with Khaled Mashal, the head of the political bureau of Hamas, in order to achieve, quote, comprehensive Palestinian reconciliation, end quote. The meeting has been scheduled for the 25th of November and will be used to try and implement the National Unity Agreement that was signed in May. Dr. Aziz Dueck of Hamas stated that Abbas and Mashal will sign a document regarding the implementation of the Unity Agreement and that the meeting is considered, quote, an ice-breaking meeting between Fatah and Hamas and not a new wave of talks, end quote. The meeting between the two parties will also be used to decide the details for the upcoming elections, which are due to be held next year, as well as the makeup of the interim government. Reports this week said that the current Prime Minister, Salam Fayyad, was still Abbas's choice to lead the caretaker government. For IMEMC News, this is Adam Carey.
This week saw continued attacks by the Israeli military on the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. 4 Palestinians have been killed as a result, and 17 civilians have been injured. The wounded include a child, a pregnant woman, and 5 naval police. 14 people have been detained, including 3 fishermen from Gaza. And countless homes have been raided. IMEMC's William Gibson with the details.
The United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs published a report that compared to 2010, this year witnessed a 40% increase in attacks carried out by Israeli settlers against the Palestinians. The OCHA report revealed that 3 Palestinians, including 2 children, were killed by Israeli settlers in 2011 and that 167 were injured. Israeli settlers also uprooted, damaged or destroyed more than 10,000 Palestinian olive trees in 2011, significantly undermining the livelihoods of hundreds of families. On Saturday night, clashes took place between dozens of Palestinians and Israeli soldiers after the army invaded Silwan town, south of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem. The soldiers fired gas bombs and concussion grenades at the protesters, also hitting a number of homes in the area, while local youth responded by hurling stones and empty bottles, and sources said that soldiers arrested one resident, Mahmoud Atiyah, aged 20, in Beir Ayub neighbourhood. At dawn on Monday, the Israeli Air Force bombarded a naval police station northwest of Beit Lahia in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. The French consul in the Gaza Strip, Maj Shakoura, lived 200 metres away, yet him and his family did not escape the blasts. His windows all shattered, he suffered shrapnel injuries along with his 13-year-old daughter, and his 2-month pregnant wife suffered a miscarriage. 22-year-old First Sergeant Mohamed Al-Khaleni died in the attack and 5 other naval policemen were injured. Arrests were made earlier in the week after Rashad Karaja, an uncle of one of the recently freed detainees, was arrested after the army invaded Safa village at dawn on Tuesday. 2 others were arrested in a separate sweep in Jenin. On Wednesday, more strikes occurred as Israeli aircraft targets various regions along the coast. Medical sources confirmed that 3 people were injured in the attacks that occurred at dawn. During the evening, Palestinian prisoners TV show host Israel Sahab was detained by the Israeli police after being served a notice to attend a nearby police station. The following morning, during Thursday at dawn, 7 arrests were made across the West Bank, 2 of whom were arrested in Dura town and a 3rd in Samar in the Hebron district. 4 more youth, all aged 17, were arrested after soldiers raided the town of Azun, east of the northern West Bank city of Qalqilya. Israeli soldiers instigated a checkpoint south of Nablus at Beita entrance, preventing Palestinians from passing through it. Any Palestinian car passing was searched, but no arrests were made nor any reasons given. Earlier today, Friday, a group of Israeli settlers attacked a family in Al-Khader village near Bethlehem while they were on their farm. Hassan Salah, one of the family members, said that they were surprised when they saw the settlers cultivating olive trees on their land. The settlers used their sticks and dogs to assault them when they tried to stop them. This resulted in the injuries of the mother, aged 70. For IMEMC News, this is William Gibson.
And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Mikibai Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Ghassan Barnoura and Hassam Kassis.
In mid-October, Israel and Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Party that controls Gaza, agreed to a prisoner swap. 1,027 Palestinian political prisoners were traded for the release of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who has been held by Hamas since June 2006. Many Israelis were horrified by the release of Palestinians, some of whom had been convicted for violent crimes against Israelis. And some Palestinians were angry that many of the prisoners released were sent into exile. On a just-concluded trip to Israel and Palestine, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended a talk by Clea Towan, the international advocacy officer, with Adamir, a Palestinian prisoner support and human rights association. She discusses the large number of Palestinians who have been arrested under the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, all but 0.3% of whom have been convicted, and the growing crackdown on the rights of those prisoners held inside Israel in violation of international law, the group says they've documented.
Since 1967, more than 700,000 Palestinians have been arrested by the Israeli authorities. That number represents about 20% of the total population, of a total Palestinian population. And when you consider that most of the people who are being arrested are men, it actually represents about 40% of the male Palestinian population. And there are kind of five broad categories of offenses. The first one is named by Israel hostile terrorist activities. So that's anything to do with military activities, but it means any activity that's carried out in the context of membership of what Israel calls an illegal organization. So if you, for example, write a political slogan on the wall, or you serve coffee to somebody who is associated with an organization that's considered illegal by Israel, you can be arrested under this category of hostile terrorist activities. And you have to remember that all the political parties in Palestine are considered illegal. So Israel's official peace partners are also considered illegal. So it's really a means to arrest pretty much anyone you want, and you can use the law to arrest whoever you want to. The second category of offenses is something that's called disruptions of a public order, and that covers a wide range of civic activities. So any activities, civic activities like organizing a demonstration or taking part in a demonstration of more than 10 people, writing slogans on the wall, any distributing the Palestinian flag, all of these activities are considered illegal by Israel, and they can be penalized with up to 10 years in prison. And all of these offenses are categorized as disruptions of a public order. So you have these hostile terrorist activities and the disruptions of a public order, and those are the two categories that Adamir works on. Then you have three other categories that relate to criminal prisoners, and there it's Palestinians being arrested in areas B and C of the West Bank for either classic criminal offenses like theft or murder or anything like that, or traffic violations. You can actually be arrested by Israel for violating traffic laws in the occupied West Bank. And then finally, you have illegal entry into Israel. So that's usually Palestinians entering Israel to try to find work. And the majority of the criminal prisoners are actually Palestinians who are just trying to find work in Israel and cross into Israel illegally. Now, these Palestinians who are arrested for these offenses are held in approximately 17 prisons, all of which, except for one, are located inside Israel and not in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to international humanitarian law, a protected person who's arrested by the occupying power should be held inside the occupied territory, not outside of it. And transferring the population is illegal. So the very establishment of these prisons inside of Israel is illegal. But in addition to that, it also means that visits by families and by lawyers are very difficult because families have to obtain permission to enter Israel from the Israeli authorities. Very often they're denied. Only immediate family members are allowed to go and visit, so parents, brothers, sisters, children. Nobody else from an extended family is allowed to visit. If you're a Palestinian lawyer from the West Bank, you are in fact not allowed to visit your client inside a prison in Israel. So these lawyers will only be allowed to see their client during the trials which take place in military tribunals that are located in the OPT. So it has, not only is it illegal, but it has consequences on not only family visits, but also the right to an effective defense.
There has been a kind of steady worsening of the detention conditions in that sense in the past few years. In the early phases of the occupation, detention was seen as a time as well where you could be educated, you could become more politically involved because the prison life was much more organized. In recent years, more and more prisoners are being denied education. And in fact, just when the deal was announced, there was a hunger strike by a large number of prisoners who were protesting a number of measures that had been taken after a speech by Prime Minister Netanyahu on the 23rd of June. And those measures related to education, they related to family visits. And essentially what Netanyahu said is that because Gilad Shalit was still being incarcerated, Palestinian prisoners should be punished. They should not have these generous, he called them overly generous, detention conditions. And until the release of Gilad Shalit, all their privileges should be withdrawn. So what happened after that speech is that all access to education was banned. Prisoners were cuffed to and from family visits. In some cases, family visits were reduced from 45 minutes to 30 minutes. They had no access to newspapers, to books, and other educational materials. They had limited access to TV, and a number of other measures were taken by the Israeli prison service. So the prisoners went on a hunger strike on the 27th of September to protest all these measures. And then obviously the prisoner exchange deal was announced in the middle of a hunger strike, in their third week of hunger strike. But up until now, we still don't know if those conditions will be reversed. So although they were all linked specifically to the detention of Gilad Shalit, and Gilad Shalit is now free, there still hasn't been an official announcement by the Israeli prison service that those measures would be withdrawn.
That was Clea Towan, the International Advocacy Officer with a prisoners' rights group, Adamir. Find more information on the work of Adamir on our website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan, Wednesday. NATO is reporting the deaths of four soldiers of unspecified nationality from IED attacks in an unspecified insurgent attack in undisclosed locations. Afghanistan, yesterday, NATO is reporting the deaths of two more soldiers of unspecified nationalities from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, yesterday, insurgents fired two rockets towards a site where more than 2,000 Afghan elders are attending a national assembly known as the Loya Jirga to discuss the future of the U.S. military prisons in Afghanistan, according to officials. Both rockets missed their targets, but one man was injured. Pakistan, today, a U.S. drone strike killed eight alleged militants, including foreigners, in a North Waziristan tribal region along the Afghan border, according to local intelligence officials. Four alleged militants were also wounded in the attack. Abu Ghraib, Iraq, today. Two policemen were killed and nine others were wounded in three separate bombings in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. The back-to-back bombings targeted mosques in the district of Abu Ghraib, 29 kilometers west of Baghdad, reported the Iraqi website Al-Samaria News, quoting a security official. Mosul, Iraq, today. Four roadside bombings and one grenade attack killed three people and wounded three. Al-Anbar Province, Iraq, today. Five people were killed and three injured from one family in the bombing of a policeman's home in Salkia, north of Fallujah, according to security sources. Mr. Barack Obama, after 8 years of war, bombs still go off every day in Baghdad. What makes you think you can do any better in Afghanistan? Now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home, today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com.
Just 2 days short of their two-month anniversary, New York City police swept into Lower Manhattan Zuccotti Park, the original site of the Occupy Wall Street protest movement, and evicted activists, arrested 200 people committing nonviolent civil disobedience, and carted their tents and property away. A member of the city council and journalists were arrested during the raid. New York City's Mayor Michael Bloomberg justified the eviction, saying that health and safety conditions had become intolerable in the park, a statement disputed by Occupy activists. Bloomberg told protesters they could return to the park, but without tents or tarps, an order upheld by a New York State Supreme Court judge. The unannounced New York City police raid in the early morning hours of November 15th came as similar suppression tactics were used against Occupy protest encampments in other cities across the U.S. Evictions carried out by police had earlier targeted protesters on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley and in Oakland, California. With the initial rapid expansion of the Occupy movement, established to protest corporate greed, growing income inequality, and political corruption, followed now by government action to suppress the encampments, activists are now confronted with important decisions on how best to disseminate their message, gain wider public support, and affect policy. Your reporter spoke with journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper and a co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, published by activists in Zuccotti Park. Here, Gupta discusses New York City's decision to dismantle the original Occupy Wall Street encampment and the tactical and strategic choices that must now be made by the Occupy movement.
It's violent, it's excessive, it's hypocritical, and it's to be expected. This is the revenge of the 1%. They have been trying to attack this movement since the beginning in New York City. There was a series of mass arrests and attacks on September 24th and October 1st. About a month ago, we saw that whole spectacle of Bloomberg claiming everyone had to leave so they could clean the park. And then he ended up backing down when there was an enormous outcry. We've seen in many other cities attacks saying that, oh, there's violence, you know, in cities like Oakland, an extremely violent city. We see hypocritical appeals to the First Amendment that somehow people in public spaces exercising their democratic speech, having more democracy, is denying others any democracy when there was virtually none to begin with. So they want to shut it down, the 1%, because it is basically made the extreme concentration of power and wealth the number one political issue. And that means if this continues to be an issue, they will have to give up some of their power and wealth, or it will be taken from them.
Arun, do you see this police action in New York City and the other similar suppression tactics around the country as being a handicap to this movement or actually energizing it? Because we've seen outpouring of support after police action similar to this in the past in Oakland, as well as New York City and many other places around the country.
Well, it depends. You know, it's based on how each individual movement responds to it. So far in New York, it was those two police attacks on September 24th, which produced that infamous viral video of police pepper spraying women who were just standing on a sidewalk. And then a week later, over 700 people were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. Those two incidents really built the movement. It brought it to national and international attention. Of course, what happened in Oakland also with the very violent police response, that sparked the general strike in that city. But in a lot of smaller cities that I've visited or been to, you know, it has not shut down the movement, but it's created difficulties. Every successful social movement is going to be repressed because what they're doing is exposing the corruption of the dominant order. So the dominant order is going to counterattack. So the question is, how do they respond by trying to circumvent and overcome this repression?
Arun, how important is occupying public space to the growth of this movement? Is it symbolic only, or is it of critical importance to keep the movement growing and expanding its reach?
Occupying space is what created this movement. There wasn't this movement before the occupations began. What there was were a lot of great people doing important work out there, a lot of organizations. There was massive discontent and despair, and what the Occupy movement shaped it, it turned that despair into hope, and it created this movement of the 99%. There was no discussion beforehand of the 99%. So having these physical occupations allowed people to come there and engage in real democratic decision-making, participatory democracy. And so many people who I've talked to at all these occupations I've visited said for the first time in their life, they felt their voice mattered. It was like an epiphany to find so many other people who were dealing with the same issues they were dealing with, lack of health care, not enough employment, about to lose their home, you know, onerous student debt. And they felt isolated. And what this did was really bring all these people together in a way that created the community that made them feel that they were creating the new society. Now, that's what it did up to this point. Going forward, I think these public spaces are important because we don't have any sort of democratic, public democratic forum in this country. That's why it became a social virus that spread and mutated so rapidly. But the movement needs to think about how it's going to respond, and part of that can be different types of occupations. We're seeing an Occupy the Universities and Campus movement. Occupations of workplaces are important. Occupations where goods are being shipped or transported are important. On Thursday, November 17th, there's a planned occupation of Wall Street in terms of protesters are going to try to peacefully, nonviolently shut down the New York Stock Exchange itself through mass of numbers. And so that's a different form of occupation. So, yes, the public spaces are important, but the public spaces are not everything.
That was journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper. For more news, analysis, and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement, visit our Between the Lines special Occupy Wall Street coverage and resource page at btlonline.org.
Early a.m. on the 15th of November, the New York Police Department staged a brutal and very violent police raid on Occupy Wall Street. A little after 6 p.m. on the 15th of November, Occupy D.C. stormed the D.C. offices of Bloomfield Office Properties, the so-called owner of Zuccotti Park, home of Occupy Wall Street.
Doors are open! Storm it!
Occupy D.C. visited the offices of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, having found evidence that 18 mayors staged a conference call to coordinate raids on Occupy encampments through the conference.
Excuse me. being occupied.
About it being occupied.
What do we say to that?
What do we say to that?
Hell no!
Hell no!
No!
Hell no!
No!
Hell 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 no!
Finally, Occupy DC stopped by the White House to remind Obama that failure to get control of the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the Department of Homeland Security, which also helped coordinate the raids, could cost them the election by sending Occupy voters home in 2012. By the time Occupy DC got back to their camp at McPherson Square, word was out, Occupy Wall Street protesters had managed to return to Zuccotti Park, also known as Liberty Square in New York City. Here's an interview with a participant in Occupy DC from Occupy DC's own radio show. The audio is not great. There's a generator or a helicopter in the background, so bear with me.
Look at the camera.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Raya. I'm with Occupy DC. I've been here for the last 3 weeks or more. I do the radio show, which is the 99% we broadcast on the website. And we try and have a lot of different topics for people to talk about and just get people to call in from different occupies around the country. That's been a really positive experience for me. I've been participating in a lot of actions. I totally support what we're doing here. I think that oftentimes we see many of these issues brought up, but the reason why they end up fading away or they end up moving on is that the conversation isn't being dropped by the current news, by the current situations going on, just pushing it to the back burner. By occupying, we keep, you know, a placeholder in these conversations. We don't let them drop, and we're just out here until our voices are going to be heard. And I've seen a lot of totally inspirational actions by people, you know, donations, you know, the togetherness, the way that people are working together. It's something you don't often see. Today, in this culture that we have, where everybody's behind a screen, everybody's Facebooking while they're talking to you, but in our occupation, people are having person-to-person conversations, they're working together, and I really support this movement, and I think that major changes need to happen in this country. There are a lot of people that are not currently served by our government. It leaves people disproportionately, you know, served by economically, in the judicial system, you know, just as far as health care. And so there's a lot of issues that need to be you know, dealt with, and I think that hopefully we'll be able to keep building and growing, and that this movement will move us into into a position where the people have more of a say in our government and in the way that it's.
That was Mariah on the Occupy DC radio show, The Voices of the 99%. From November 12th to November 17th, the fledgling new society created by the Occupy movement may have fought and won its first war. Beginning on the 12th of November, there was a nationwide series of midnight terror raids aimed at evicting Occupy camps, coordinated through the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the Department of Homeland Security. After brutal police attacks on Occupy Portland, Oakland, Denver, and so many others, the attacks culminated in New York City, where Occupy began. On the 15th of November, the New York police launched an all-out attempt to evict Occupy Wall Street. Riot cops swept through Liberty Plaza, beating anybody in their path.
I was coming back from a spokes council meeting that was on off-site, and so as I came back around the park around, I guess, 12:30, I was talking on the phone, just sort of circling the park, walking in and out, And that's when I started to notice that they brought in these enormous light rigs, lighting standards that they erected on every side of the park. It looked like Yankee Stadium out here. And that was pretty much when I realized this is definitely not something normal going on. And they began cordoning off the square, not letting anyone go in or out. And there were hundreds and hundreds of cops in riot gear, this time with actual shields and their batons drawn. And it was clear that something pretty messy was about to go down.
Now,
at
that time, my understanding is they shut down the subways stops down to Occupy Wall Street. They had grounded, essentially, all of the news helicopters, so they're not allowing them to take pictures. So what happened? Did you enter the park at that point? Were you in the park? And then what happened?
Yeah, I was in the park, and the cops were staging, and basically, once they came into the park, they pretty much came with the baton swinging. You know, they told people to get out of the park, but it was pretty much simultaneously with a raised baton, you know, aimed at your head or your stomach or your knees, and they told you basically, you know, get out of here or, you know, I'm going to beat the crap out of you. And, you know, I took the warning and proceeded, and, you know, I still ended up getting grabbed by the back of the shirt and thrown on the ground and eventually did get out of there. But it was pretty messy, and there were certainly a lot of people that got beaten pretty badly. There were some members of the people that locked themselves into the park, used like bicycle U-locks and attached themselves to trees and other things to nail themselves down. Huge plumes of pepper spray all over the place as they subdued people. And there was even a city councilman, Adonis Rodriguez, who was in the park, who was beaten pretty severely, cracked over the head. His head was split open with a baton. And although there was clearly a media blackout, and it was one of the more sinister aspects of this raid, was that Bloomberg was able to effectively clear out every form of broadcast media, including the CNN truck that sits next to the park virtually 24 hours a day. And so there was almost no broadcast coverage, but there were definitely videos inside the park, and people caught a lot of action, and so I think you're going to start to see those emerging throughout today.
Now, as there were reports last night, as I was watching the live stream, that there was use of the LRAD, the sound cannons. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, that was basically used against the people that were tied in, sort of locked themselves down and refused to get out of the park. And I did see the vehicle. I didn't hear it directly. I was out of the park at the time when they used it. But I did definitely hear confirmation from some people that they used it. And it was quite painful, apparently, to the people in the park.
The heavy truck-mounted LRAD sound cannon was used, just like at the Pittsburgh G20 protests. The NYPD closed all nearby roads and subway stations to cut off reinforcements. At least 200 people were arrested. Bulldozers smashed tents. The books in the library were destroyed. At least one report said they were burned by the police. Even some of the trees in the park were cut down before protesters escaped the attack and swarmed over Lower Manhattan. 2 days later, Occupy Wall Street struck back. The 17th of November, the two-month anniversary of the beginning of Occupy Wall Street, had already been set as a global day of action. In the morning, Occupy Wall Street managed to shut down every entry point to the area around the New York Stock Exchange, although not before enough of the traders got through the gauntlet lines to open the exchange. Police counterattacked, again using even the LRAD sound cannon, but even their heavy weapons could not blunt the numerical superiority of Occupy Wall Street. At least 30,000 protesters swarmed over Lower Manhattan. In some places, the police set checkpoints, allowing only suit and tie people to pass. All this could hope to do was contain the area, and only if a determined push did not come their way.
Down at Wall Street, it was chaotic. 175 arrests now, according to police. There were thousands of demonstrators, at least 1,500 to 2,000 and well over 1,000 police officers, many of them in riot gear. The demonstrators, in many cases, locked arms and blocked streets, and that led to their arrest. There was an arrest recently in Zuccotti Park where a young man allegedly knocked the hat off of a police officer. They went into the crowd and grabbed him and yanked him out of there. And there were at least five police officers injured today, Shepard. One was cut on the hand by some broken glass, and several had some sort of liquid thrown in their face. Apparently it was vinegar thrown in the face of police officers.
Quit whining, Fox. It sounds like you are sore that the NYPD got their asses kicked. Usually the vinegar is on our own bandanas to neutralize pepper spray. If this report is true, it is an innovative new way to put points on the board. On the afternoon of the 17th of November, Occupy Wall Street marched on the Brooklyn Bridge, while Occupy movements around the country marched on other bridges. While an estimated 20,000 people marched on the bridge, the barricades the police had erected around Liberty Plaza were torn down. At the end of the march, Occupy Wall Street returned to their campsite in triumph. Although a judge had ordered that police were only required to let individuals, not their tents and equipment, back in the park, the police will have a difficult time preventing their return without the barricades.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Here's a special call out to the Northern Rockies Independent Media Center in Bozeman, Montana, now rebroadcasting WSQT Online. And just like we have Occupy DC, there's Occupy Bozeman. On the 12th of November, Occupy Bozeman picketed a Wells Fargo bank. You may recall the history of Wells Fargo from the Old West. There's also some very special history concerning the Bozeman Trail in Montana. That was where Red Cloud fought the United States government until the United States government agreed to surrender unconditionally and abandoned the Bozeman Trail. We also know the shameful history that came later. The United States abandoned the Bozeman Trail but built the Transcontinental Railroad. The United States went back on their word to the Lakota, like they went back on their word to every Native American tribe they ever encountered, in their manifest destiny, greed and limitless expansion.
Under pressure from an effective grassroots campaign opposing government approval of the proposed 1,700-mile-long Trans-Canada Keystone XL pipeline that would bring oil from Alberta, Canada's tar sands operations to U.S. Gulf Coast refineries in Texas, the Obama administration announced a 12- to 18-month delay in making a decision on the pipeline to allow further study of the project's environmental impact. The November 10th White House announcement followed a concerted effort by a large coalition of environmental groups to derail the project that included acts of nonviolent civil disobedience, resulting in over 1,200 arrests in September. Among the concerns of the U.S. and Canadian environmental groups organizing under the banner of Tar Sands Action was the greenhouse gas emissions of tar sands crude oil, which they maintain are 40% higher than conventional oil and threaten to accelerate global warming. There is also fear that oil spills from the pipeline as it crosses Nebraska's Sand Hills region could pollute an important underground aquifer there that supplies water to several states for farm irrigation and drinking water. While pipeline opponents applauded the Obama administration's delay of a decision until after the 2012 presidential election, TransCanada said they would propose a new route that avoided the Sandhills aquifer and were confident of eventual approval. Your reporter spoke with Susan Casey Lefkowitz, director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's international program, part of the Tar Sands Action Coalition. She assesses oil industry pressure on the White House to approve the pipeline and how the delay could affect the government's final decision.
Tar sands oil is basically this very dirty form of oil that has much higher greenhouse gas emissions. But it's also symbolic of a type of oil that oil companies are going after more and more now that is more difficult to extract. And if we start going sort of to the ends of the earth to get this much dirtier form of oil, we're really not going to be able to fight climate change the way that we need to. And with people all over the United States raising concerns about this pipeline, the president made the right choice. And he said, you know, let's give this a fresh environmental review. Let's take all of these concerns of people from across America into account and take another hard look at whether this pipeline and this tar sands oil is in the national interest.
I've read recently that the TransCanada Pipeline Company is actually saying that it will reroute around a sensitive underground aquifer area in Nebraska, which was one of the reasons that there was some concern about the environmental impact. And the company says they're quite sure that if they do reroute, that the Obama administration will approve the project down the line. And it seems like this decision is being kicked down the road until after the presidential election.
Basically, the route of the pipeline, whether or not it goes through the Nebraska Sandhills and the Ogallala Aquifer, which is the main source of fresh water for 8 states in America's heartland, was one of the really critical issues at hand in the discussion and the concerns raised about this pipeline. But the other big area of concern is that of climate change. Climate change is real. Americans are feeling it every day in their lives now, seeing it in droughts and violent storms and unprecedented floods. And so what's important is that the Obama administration has made a commitment not just to look at alternative routes to the pipeline, but also to take another hard look at the environmental concerns, including climate change, in making a decision about whether this pipeline is in the nation's best interest or not.
Susan, how much pressure is there from the big oil companies and certain unions that are looking for the creation of thousands of jobs with this pipeline project? How much pressure is on the White House to, in the end, decide in favor of this pipeline?
Well, you know, I think that one reason why President Obama's decision to give a fresh environmental review to this pipeline was so courageous is that the pressure from big oil is enormous. Every major oil company in the world is sort of going after tar sands oil with this gold rush mentality. They don't really care what happens to the environment. What they care about is their bottom line and their profits. And you can see that in the type of destruction that extraction of tar sands brings. It basically, you're strip mining boreal forests and wetlands. You're fragmenting a wilderness that is, you know, a nesting site for migratory birds in order to both dig and sometimes heat and steam this very raw bitumen, it's called. It's kind of this raw tarry substance out of the earth so that eventually it can be turned into gasoline. And so what it really comes down to is enormous pressures on the president and on the State Department, I think, to move forward with the approval process. And that's exactly what they've taken a stand against doing because they heard the concerns of the American people and they want to try to get this decision right.
This XL pipeline project is symbolic of a much larger issue, and that is moving away industrial societies across the planet from fossil fuels, which produce global warming, toward a more serious focus in funding for green and renewable energy sources. That's the objective, I'm sure, the long-range objective of your campaign. You have any hope that progress is being made on that front?
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot of progress being made in terms of building clean energy alternatives, especially for moving around, you know, in terms of smart growth and public transit, in terms of getting renewable energy into the grid so that we can be using it to fuel our cars and our vehicles instead of depending so much on oil. But what's also really important, I've always found, as you push for the clean energy alternatives, is to be fighting the dirty energy. Because otherwise, you end up with oil companies who are working hard to undermine those clean energy options, which essentially are their competition.
That was Susan Casey Lefkowitz, director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's International Program. Find links to more information on the Keystone XL pipeline debate on our website at btlonline.org.
Update, update, update. TransCanada, the main financial backer of the Keystone XL pipeline, has stated that they are going to continue funding the project until it is approved or permanently rejected. CEO Russ Grilling has announced that, quote, the company will work together with Nebraska and U.S. officials to find an acceptable route within 6 to 9 months. TransCanada is using this delay to create a monetary cushion and improve their investor rating, according to Moody's Investor Service. This may mean that TransCanada's real intention is to attempt to wait out the Obama presidency, hoping that he is defeated in the 2012 election and get approval of the Keystone XL pipeline, either A, from a Republican who's sure to approve it, or B, from President Obama after the election has come and gone and he has re-election immunity. The fight to stop the Keystone XL pipeline is not over, not by a long shot. If we lose this one, it's game over for stopping catastrophic climate change.
Arizona's right-wing anti-immigrant agitator, State Senate President Russell Pierce, was recalled in a special election in his suburban Phoenix district, losing to moderate Republican Jerry Lewis, who waged a gutsy grassroots campaign. Pierce, a former deputy sheriff, is the chief architect of Arizona's SB 1070, the tough anti-immigrant law which made him a hero among many Tea Party activists. This year, Pierce pushed for more repressive legislation, including requiring health workers and school officials to enforce immigration laws. Arizona's powerful business community eventually rebelled and recruited a number of Republican legislators to oppose Pierce's right-wing agenda. In the spring, Citizens for a Better Arizona gathered 17,000 signatures to force a recall vote. Then Jerry Lewis, a Mormon and moderate Republican, stepped up to challenge Pierce. Immigration and ethics were key issues in ousting Pierce, along with a mobilized Latino community. The Senate president also suffered from an ethics scandal in accepting over $40,000 in gifts, including free trips, hotel rooms, and game tickets from the Fiesta Bowl. During a candidate's debate before the election, Lewis, a charter school executive, blamed Pierce and his anti-immigrant agenda for creating a poor business climate, declaring, "We are seen as akin to 1964 Alabama. People do not want to move their business here." Lewis refused to take PAC money during the campaign, while Pierce received large contributions from conservative special interest groups.